The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
This market has been all over the place, and it's not surprising that the market was down today because you're starting to see earnings momentum slow down and the forecast for earnings growth getting a little weaker, which is going to bring the market down. So we've had a really nice month and a half, but we're starting to see reality kick in. And the reality is that we have high interest rates and slow growth. And also something else to remember is that the market is not just the U.S. stock market. It's not just the U.S. economy. 44% of the earnings growth for the S&P 500 companies comes from outside of the United States. So as a result of that, you have to look and see how strong the world is. And the world is slowing. So you're going to start seeing that find its way into negative earnings growth for U.S. companies, which is a real negative.
From home building to home sales to mortgage lending, all of those numbers are dropping, leading the chief economists from both the home builders and the realtors to call a housing recession. Single family home construction was nearly 19% lower in July compared with the year before, and building permits, which are an indicator of future construction, fell 12%. The sticker shock of much higher mortgage rates along with inflation have buyers stepping back quickly. Homebuyer demand for mortgages is sitting at a 22-year low, and bidding wars are dropping fast. And some builders said they're now starting to lower their prices by an average of about 5%. Still, with prices up over 40% since the start of the pandemic, it's going to take a lot more cooling to call any home today a bargain.
Joe Biden has signed into law the biggest ever investment to fight climate change in the U.S. The bill, known as the Inflation Reduction Act, includes more than $400 billion of new spending. It is overwhelmingly about greener energy. Joe Biden said it was one of the most significant laws in America's history.
This bill is the biggest step forward on climate ever. It includes ensuring that we create clean energy opportunities and fight environmental injustice that's been going on for so long.
China is sending troops to Russia for a joint military exercise. General, looks to me like it's a new world order that's shaping up. United States versus Russia and China. Do you see it that way?
Oh, yes. I think it's inescapable. I mean, the strategic partnership that they formed very publicly prior to the Beijing Winter Olympics and also prior to the invasion in Ukraine, certainly this is another step to solidify that partnership. What has brought them together, quite frankly, is what you're suggesting is a new world order. They do not want the world order that has existed post-World War II, led largely by the United States and like-minded democratic countries. They want their own sphere of influence. And that is the reason for the partnership, is the reason why they're going to continue to conduct exercises together going forward. But I do believe the model we're using in Ukraine won't work dealing with Taiwan. We're providing more weapons to Ukraine after the invasion started than before. We've got to do the opposite. Provide the weapons now so that, in fact, there is a deterrence. We'd have to fight our way in there to get them weapons after a conflict started. That is what is absolutely needed in the near term going forward.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Home sales dropped in July for the sixth straight month, reflecting the longest streak of declines in more than 8 years. Rising mortgage rates are making it harder for buyers to qualify to buy homes. And on other stories, there seems to be a big disconnect between what Wall Street believes on a Fed pivot and what the Fed is actually saying about future rate hikes. Currently, the market sees a close to 70% probability of another 75 basis point hike coming next month, which would take the Fed funds rate to 3%. As rates rise, it's going to make the interest the government pays on debt rise significantly, as our debt is now rising faster than economic growth. The major indexes finished out the week with net losses. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up at the top of the hour, Ralph Ancampora joins me. Ralph is currently bullish, but warns that the July lows need to hold going forward. Ralph likes blue-chip dividend-paying stocks, especially utilities, which are making new record highs. Following Ralph will be Dr. Charles Hall, the professor who invented the concept of EROI, Energy Return on Investment. Dr. Hall points out that EROI is falling in all areas of energy, from fossil fuels as peak oil approaches, and green energy, which is proving to be more costly with poor returns on investment. Dr. Hall suggests we need to pivot soon, or we may be heading into a major energy crisis, a thesis I first wrote about in the spring of 2020. Before we get to our guests, let's find out what stories move the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
Most of the news this week circled around inflation data points and the Fed's minutes, with some comments from a few Fed FOMC voters. Secondly, earnings announcements had some influence on consumer discretionary stocks and in semiconductors as industry groups. And finally, there was some mixed economic news this week to discuss. So let's start on the inflationary front. This week, the United Kingdom reported a 40-year high in consumer inflation. And Friday, Germany's producer price index, or PPI, was up 37.2% year-over-year in July. And Japan's core consumer price index was up 2.4%, the fastest since 2014. The end result of these numbers pressed our treasury yields higher on the week, up 14 basis points for the 10-year and up 6 basis points for the 2-year. So a bit of a yield curve steepening this week. The Federal Open Market Committee's minutes were released on Wednesday, which basically said stagflation without saying it. Participants focused on the appropriateness of moderating the pace of rate hikes in the future to assess their impact, as they recognize there is a transmission lag from their policy decisions on the economy. They also recognize some weakness in certain industries and areas, and that's the stagflation part of it. The stock market originally rallied off the news, as this confirmed the rally preceding the consumer price index data point earlier this month, and comments from Powell following the last hike in July that the pace of rate hikes could moderate, but profit-taking took over after that, placing the S&P 500 and NASDAQ in negative territory by Wednesday's close. Three of Fed officials voiced their opinions on rates Thursday, but it didn't really do much to move the markets. Kashkari relented that he isn't sure the Fed can fight inflation without sending the economy into recession. He will be a voter for the FOMC next year. Bullard, a voter this year, said he's leaning on a 75 basis point hike in September. And George said she's encouraged by the July report, but said it's no time for a victory lap. These comments seem to cause Treasury yields to dip very slightly. On the second item this week, earnings. Home Depot and Walmart reported better than expected earnings in the second quarter, causing the retail group to shine Tuesday. Additionally, heavily shorted stocks like GameStop, Blue Apron, and Bed Bath & Beyond were up big on news. That marked the top of the retail group, as the following day results from Target that were worse than expected caused the group to sell off despite strong earnings gains from TJX and Lowe's, which bucked the trend. Then Kohl's the following day on Thursday had a weak showing, and finally overall weakness on options expiration day Friday fueled quite a bit of selling, including some devastation for some of the meme stocks, including Bed Bath & Beyond, which was down 40%. On news, Ryan Cohen's RC Ventures completed the sale of its stake in the company, and news in a Bloomberg law report that the company was seeking help from law companies to address its debt. Despite the bad finish to the week, the S&P 500 retail ETF XRT was only down 2.8% on mixed earnings news this week. Wolfspeed's positive earnings and guidance Thursday helped drive the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index up 2.2% on the day. However, that was reversed on Friday due to cautionary comments from Applied Materials, along with its earnings report that saw the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index fall approximately 2.8%. Finally, the economic news this week was mixed. The housing data wasn't good, and that led to weakness in home builders overall this week. The NAHB housing index fell to 49 from 54 prior. Housing starts fell 9.6% month over month, and building permits were also down from highs earlier this year, while existing home sales fell 5.9% month over month, the sixth consecutive month that these sales have fallen. Now, we also got the regional survey data for August, so we started to see how August is playing out, and that's mixed. Go figure. Everything is mixed right now. Empire State Manufacturing down to negative 31 from a positive 11 in the previous month, while the Philadelphia Fed Index rose to 6.2 in August from a negative 12.3. So a bit of a recovery there. We've been watching jobless claims closely each week as it's a leading indicator. There's no decisive information on a turn as of yet, with claims actually falling for the week to 250,000 from 266 last week. Still a long ways away from recessionary levels, which supports the idea the Fed can and probably should continue to be restrictive. Retail sales were flat month to month in July, dragged down by motor vehicle sales and gas station sales. But if you take that group out, take out the autos, it was actually up 0.4%. The week's close for the S&P 500 was down 1.2%, ending the 4 weeks of consecutive closes higher. Next week will be the Federal Reserve's annual Jackson Hole Symposium from August 25th through 27th, so the Fed speak will be louder than usual. Reuters wrote a nice article last Friday that suggested the platform would be a good opportunity for Powell to walk us through the Fed's intentions with quantitative tightening, essentially unwinding its balance sheet. This will be more important as it appears investors have become comfortable with the Fed's current glide path for interest rates and the thought process there that they may moderate the pace later in the year and go month to month on their decisions. So, inflation pressures overseas settling in on yields higher here, mixed earnings results in retail and semiconductors, and finally, mixed economic news has led to some profit-taking at the end of the week following a strong showing in July and August for stocks. Up next, technician Ralph Acampora to weigh in on the market's latest trends.
If we do wind up having a recession, and some people believe it, we actually are in recession because we had two consecutive negative growth rates for GDP in the first and second quarter. But they were very minor decreases, and GDP is prone to be revised. So it could be revised higher, actually. But let's just put that behind us and say that it was a technical recession, not one that's likely to make the history books. But if there's one still ahead of us, it would be the most anticipated recession of all times. And if that's the case, then in some ways, because we're so many people are worrying about it, it's bound to be very mild because a lot of the excesses that typically cause severe recessions, certainly people are being cautious and careful here.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the stock market has been going up since early July. Will it continue, or is this just a bear market bounce? Let's find out. Joining me on the program is Ralph Acampora. Ralph, let's begin with Papa Dow. It is right there at that 200-day moving average. What's your take on the markets here? Where do you think they're heading?
Well, if you're literally talking about Papa Dow, Charles Dow, he didn't know anything about moving averages, and that was not in his bailiwick at the time. But he was good, and I always look at Dow, and it's two averages, the Dow Industrials and the Dow Transportation, as many people know. What you need to see to get a primary bull market for Dow theory, okay? You had the low in June and July. Both averages made nice lows. That's good. You have the rally here, okay, coming off those lows. Need a correction for Dow theory. You need a correction, some kind of a correction, which I think we're experiencing right now. And then new highs. You get those new recovery highs, then Dow theory would kick in and say you have a bull market. So we're in the process of trying to create that. As far as I'm concerned, the June, July lows, I think the last time we were talking, I said it was my red line. Maybe I was talking to someone else. I said they have to hold. And so far, they've been holding very well. On a very short-term basis, though, Jim, the market is overbought, and that's why you're seeing it stall here. But it's correcting in a very orderly manner. I like the action. Looks good.
Is there anything that really stands out to you that looks attractive? Like I've been, we own the utility. So we own XLU, which has been breaking out, obviously.
All-time new highs.
Yeah. Anything other than utilities that looks attractive to you from looking at the charts?
I think Apple is an indication of at least that stock and what's happening in technology is starting to come back. So I would keep my eye on that. Apple actually had a huge move here. It needs to pull back. I would add to the position if I had. I have a position. But anyway, yeah. So the technology is I'm a little disappointed with the financials. They're lagging. They're coming back, but they're not as strong as I'd like to see.
So when you look at this market, Ralph, one of the things that really struck me, if you would have told me we would have been seeing the highest inflation rates that we've seen in four decades and gold would be falling, I would have said you're crazy, but that's exactly what's happened.
Absolutely. And then you look over your shoulder and we got a war going on in Europe. I mean, it's insane. And COVID, you know, turning around and popping up all over the place and then it's not popping up. But I have to say, I think the declines that we had earlier this year, first half of the year, and to a great degree is, I discounted a lot of it. I won't say all of it because there are surprises out there. Who knows what China is going to do with Taiwan, you know, all this crazy stuff. But, and then the elections coming up here in November.
Yeah, there's so many cross currents today. I can't remember so many cross currents, whether it's the war in Ukraine, conflict in South China Seas. You've got all kinds of problems going on. You've got a very divided country, in my opinion, right now.
I'm glad you said that. I don't want to get involved in politics, but boy, oh boy, I wish they'd shut off tell these guys to go home.
Maybe put them on recess or something. We'd probably get along.
Yeah. You know what I would love to see on television? Now, again, I'm not pointing fingers at any, but you know the stations and where their biases are. Get a station that would have a Democrat and a Republican sitting next to each other and say, oh, all right, today's topic is, and talk about it, politely talk about it. I would love a TV show like that. If anybody was smart, they'd put a show like that on, and the public would want to hear.
Both sides of the argument.
Both sides of the argument, very politely talking and discussing whatever the issue is.
Yeah. Seems like they're both at each other's throats. I want to go on to another commodity, which, you know, every time we've ever had a recession, Ralph, preceding that recession has been a spike in oil prices and interest rates. Let's talk about oil, which got up to over 120. It's down below 90 now. What's your take on energy here?
I was looking at it earlier this morning, and I see it start to slowly come back. I think the bottoms are in for a while. I'm not looking for a huge move on the upside, but I think there's still a lot of conflict out there. And I think energy stays at current level, maybe corrects a little bit. I'm neutral to slightly positive in energy.
Okay. Now, I know you and I have discussed in the past on this, and I'm a big believer in dividend stocks, especially with the way the tax laws are configured, where you could pay zero taxes on dividends depending on your income. And you've been a big advocate of that, especially with your wife, Rosemary, who did an excellent job for clients with dividend stocks. What's your take on a lot of these dividends look very attractive?
Oh, yes. I think Rosemary was talking not too long ago about Caterpillar increasing its dividend and stocks like that. Yeah, no, name brands, companies that you know and respect and are major entities in their various sectors are increasing their dividends. And yes, you're absolutely right. If you're talking long term and you're talking about investing for the for your retirement, for sure, absolutely, dividends must be considered.
You know, it's just amazing. You know, one of the things I think people get confused, Ralph, is when they see the stock price go down, they think, oh, I'm going to lose my income. But when you own a high quality dividend paying stock, I think people would be surprised, even though the stock price may be down, the company still may be raising their dividends.
You're going to laugh when I tell you this. I've had a lot of discussions with Rosemary. You know, when I see a bear market coming, I say, honey, we got to get out. And she's, be quiet. Everything's fine. She said, we got the dividend. We can live with a little weakness in price. You know, long term, she's right.
Well, I mean,
don't tell her.
Yeah. Well, I remember you tell me that a lot of times you'd go to Rosemary and you'd look at your technical indicators, especially like in the financial crisis, and you know the market's going down, but you hold.
Yeah, she does.
So outside of, let's say, we're taking a look at utilities that are breaking out, anything else that you like consumer staples, consumer cyclicals? One of the things that really struck me is the consumer discretionary stocks have been doing well. So what does that tell us about the economy?
Yeah, well, there you go. I was going to mention consumer discretionary making new recovery highs, not all-time highs, not yet anyway. And I think it's saying that we're going to get past this, you know, economic crisis. And we just have to live with the uncertainties for a while.
So if you were looking at right now, Ralph, what would be the key things you would want to see to tell you that, hey, it may be time to start putting some money to work?
Well, I advise some funds, and we were nibbling. We didn't catch the absolute low. I never do, rarely. But I advised people in July and August, actually, pounding the table, saying that if you like a situation like financials and you're willing to live with some weakness in that, then you can slowly nibble. And we went into stocks like Apple and things like that that weren't that obvious at the time that it made an important low. But I would say to people, pick the stocks that you feel very comfortable with owning fundamentally, okay? Fundamentally, that you could live with during periods of weakness, or willing to add to if the market suffers another setback. That's the way I would approach it. I would, you know, look for the blue chips. Go look, go look at the top stocks in the S&P 500, and you know, go look at Amazon and Google and things like that that you feel that you might want to own longer term and take advantage of any kind of weakness to add to.
And Ralph, don't a lot of fund managers, you know, usually when you go through a bear market, you've got a decline in stocks as we saw earlier in the year. When the market comes back, people tend, or at least I have found, managers tend to be a little bit more conservative, so they go for quality rather than something that's high flying.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. The first leg of a bull market is led with quality, blue chips, because people suffered on the way down and they're more cautious, and rightly so. I mean, we're all human beings. Think, oh, I don't want to take a risk now. The second part of a bull market is that, well, gee, I did well with these blue chip stocks. Let me look at some secondaries. You know, they're not cheap stocks, but they're not the bluest of blue chips, but they look good. And then the third and final emotional stage of a bull market is when people say, ah, the heck with all that blue stuff. I'm going to buy some real low-priced, you know, aggressive stocks. So that's the psychology. So if people are starting to come back and they're in this let me stay quality mood, that's part of what I look for as a emotional bottom for the market. So that's actually a good sign. And I still talk to people who are unwilling to be somewhat aggressive, even willing to say that maybe we might have made a low. And that's good. I like people who are doubtful. If they were pounding on my door and say, "Hey, Rao, come on, give me an idea," I'd be worried about that.
So right now, from your standpoint, and might be some time to put some money to work on some high quality names, and especially companies that are doing well fundamentally?
Yes, absolutely.
And if there was anything that would change that view, what would that be?
Well, this is, I think, very obvious. If the market rolled over and took out those May, June, July lows, it depends on what sectors and group you're looking at, that would be very, very major concern to me, that this was indeed a rally in a bear market, and that would be the beginning of the final leg of a bear market. As I mentioned before, I'm kind of leaning that those lows are pretty good, and they're going to hold during any kind of a pullback. Now, you know, getting very technical for a second, you mentioned utilities. I said they're at all-time new highs. That's amazing, because I can't find anything at all-time new highs right now. Okay, so that's unusual. And a lot of the stocks, a lot of the sectors are coming up to areas with the previous highs of earlier this year, late last year. And that's, in the terms of a technician, that's supply or resistance overhead. And that should slow the longer term picture a little bit. And it's not super negative, but it's the reality of the market is that we've had a good move here, surprisingly, I think, for a lot of people, on the upside here in the last few weeks, month or so. And that should slow down a little bit.
Okay, so if we were to sum it up, maybe some time to put some money to work, stick with quality, stick with good fundamentals, and you're probably going to come out all right.
Yeah, I think you know, September could historically be a kind of a corrective month. Then you got the year-end rally. I think we're going to have a good year-end rally.
All right. Well, listen, Ralph, you stay healthy. Oh, by the way, how's the barn coming along? You got all four walls of that barn covered now?
Yes, I'm on the west wall. That's my last wall. That's where the entrance is. The pitch of the wall, the pitch of the barn there, as it peaks. And I tell everybody I waited to do the last part of my wall with that pitch in it, because it gives me room for the Dow to go to 100,000.
Okay.
And I said to everybody, for me to get to the final end and complete the whole bond, I'll be 112 years old, and I'll be there.
Okay. Well, I hope so too, and hope to be talking to you then.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we are committed to helping you build, maintain, and preserve your wealth. Contact us today to find out about our comprehensive financial planning and asset management services. Whether you're planning for retirement, taxes, putting together an estate plan, or need assistance in managing a 401k, Financial Sense Wealth Management is here to help. Give us a call to speak with one of our certified financial planners or wealth advisors at 888-486-3939. Or go to financialsense.com and hit where it says Contact Us. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the administration just signed a Green New Deal program that's going to enhance energy in this country, but where are we heading? We're trying to make a transition from fossil fuels to clean energy. Will that work? Well, let's find out. Joining me on the program is Dr. Charles Hall. He's Professor Emeritus from the College of Environmental Science and Forestry at the State University of New York. And Professor, I want to start out with something that you have been credited in EROI. Energy return on investment. Can you explain what that is and the significance it plays when we're looking at alternative energy sources?
The concept started in my PhD work, where I looked at the energy that fish used in migration and their energy return by being in different environments at different times of their life cycle. So they invest energy in migration, and they have a return by being able in a more food-rich environment at different points in their life cycle. So that's where the concept came from. And I'd like to point out that I'm trained as a systems ecologist under the great systems ecologist Howard Odom. And my focus was initially to study energy in natural ecosystems. And I had no interest initially in human-dominated ecosystems. But in 1980 or so, I had this really good undergraduate. I was at Cornell University at the time, a young professor. And he came to me and he said that he was interested in doing some project. And I was like to encourage students to particular projects. And he said he wanted to do something with energy. So I said, well, you know, let's take a look at energy return on investment. I initially said, let's re-examine Hubbard's theory. That's a different issue. With respect to oil, and that sort of evolved into looking at energy return on investment for oil. And so we wrote a paper that was published in Science in 1981. It was on the first page of the Wall Street Journal. And we found that the energy return on investment for oil in the United States was declining over time, that as we used up the best oil resources, it became more and more energy intensive to get the next barrel of oil, or for each barrel of oil invested in looking for additional oil, you got less over time. And so that started me becoming interested in this concept as it was playing out in society. And to answer your other question, why was it important for whatever lies down the road for us, and perhaps for this legislation, is that initially the energy return on investment for renewables was much less than that for fossil fuels. But if you include all of the energy costs of dealing with the intermittency of renewables, the wind blows only about a third of the time and the sun shines in the daytime and not at night. Storing electricity is a very, very difficult and expensive proposition. And so dealing with all of that, it's going to be a very difficult transition, I think, to go from fossil fuels, which you can turn on and off at will, including in electric generating plant, to renewables that are at the whim of whatever nature is up to. So you can have a period of 2 or 3 weeks where there's no wind at all. And if you're dependent upon wind turbines, that's a tough deal to deal with.
I want to go to the return on energy, especially fossil fuels, that has been dropping. The late Matt Simmons wrote a book, Twilight in the Desert, where he talked about, and most people don't realize, even though we have tens of thousands of oil fields around the globe, there's really the giants that were discovered 50, 70 years ago, like Garwar, that we got most of our oil. As we have had to go offshore, as we've had to go to shale, it's costing more to find that. So hence your EROI has been declining on that. Let's talk about this renewable, because it seems to me, I live in California where we're always having brownouts all the time. And we've just shut down one of our nuclear power plants. I don't know if we'll shut down the other one, but we're talking about going to intermittent sources of power, which, as you're talking about, solar and wind, which are less dependable. At the same time, we're making everybody move towards an EV. In fact, in California, you're not going to be able to buy a combustion engine car after 2035, and you won't have a diesel truck in this state after 2030. Let's talk about the EROI on this, because it's, as you mentioned, it's far less.
than fossil fuels?
Well, first of all, I knew Matt Simmons, and I certainly agree with him that half our oil comes from 400 very large fields called elephants, like Ghawar in Saudi Arabia. But even that of beginning to reach the end of its productive lifetime. And so now we're trying to extract oil from drilling tens of thousands of smaller wells and getting less oil from them than we used to get from the large ones. So yes, that's a problem. I live just north of you in Ashland, Oregon. So whatever problems you're having, I'm familiar with. And I know the guy who's in charge of programming energy for electricity for California, and he says that he's got so much electricity at noon on a sunny day in Southern California that it's burning out the transformers at substations. He can't shed this much electricity, and then he doesn't have enough at 6 o'clock when everybody comes home and turns on their air conditioner. So, yeah, that's certainly a problem that you're dealing with in California. And is it resolvable? It will be resolved one way or another. It may not be resolved in a way that's very easy for Californians. Probably the best way to deal with that is to have gas turbines running on natural gas, which is basically putting a jet engine on a pedestal and attaching a generator to it. So you can bring that up and down very quickly. But you're still left with the problem of too much electricity in the middle of the day, of a sunny day, and not enough at other times. And a lot of people are working hard to try to resolve that, and there's no easy resolution. The best way to store energy is as elevated water. But California is not awash in water at the moment, so that's a problem too. I think all of the batteries in the world store less than 1 minute's worth of electricity generation. It's a massive problem.
So, Professor, what about alternatives? Like we just shut down one nuclear power plant. Nuclear power plants are very efficient. They're dependable. What about nuclear, and why, if we're worried about climate change, are we shutting down our power plants? There seems to be an anti-nuclear sentiment within the environmental industry in the U.S.
Well, I want to sort of step carefully here because I don't like to promote this or that. I like to be just to do the science as best I can. I mean, science isn't about defending this position or not. It's about testing hypotheses, or should be, and too much science is used to support one side or another in an argument. But, as a citizen, not as a scientist, I support nuclear power. As a scientist, I ask this question. If you want to save the atmosphere with nuclear power, you're going to have to be building nuclear plants at so many a month around the world. You have to just build a massive number of nuclear plants. And if we're going to put this much nuclear technology into the world, I worry about proliferation. People, and that isn't necessarily just making nuclear bombs, it's making dirty radioactive devices and so forth. You're dealing with some nasty stuff, of course. So in a certain sense, I'm pro-nuclear. In a certain sense, I'm very worried about proliferation. I do not have an official position on that. If you could do it with great safeguards, then it makes a lot of sense. But I guess I'm a little bit nervous about that.
What about hydrogen?
Well, hydrogen isn't an energy source. It's like electricity. It's what we call an energy carrier. You can make it, you can use it in a certain sense for storage. So if you have too much electricity at noon, you can split water with getting hydrogen But hydrogen is a very small molecule. It's one eighth or something of whatever methane is and natural gas is. And so it's really hard to store, and it's extremely hard to move through a pipeline because the molecule is so small, it leaks very easily. Now, doesn't say you can't do it. It's just, again, very, very difficult. And it's not a source of energy. You can only use it as a storage from electricity. So if that's what we want to go, the efficiency of turning hydrogen into your final product is very low, 20% or so. So it has difficulties as well. If you're looking for me to come up with a policy, okay, I don't like to do this. I'm a scientist. I'm not a policy person. But I think that's what you're pushing me to do. Is that right?
Well, I'm just trying to get, you know, we're talking about a major energy transition. And as I studied history, you know, we started with wood, we went to coal, and then we went to oil and gas. And these energy transitions take time. I mean, you don't do it in 10 years by legislative fiat. And I'm just concerned about, in terms of the direction that we're heading onto an unreliable source of energy. As you mentioned, during the day, we've got too much energy. And at night, when you need it the most, we don't have enough.
Well, look, you're looking for an easy answer to continue living the way that we are. And there are none. Just let me state that right there. There are no easy answers. And it's a lot worse than probably you understand, because we only have about half as much oil as the official estimates. The energy return on investment is declining on everything we're dealing with. We have to take our remaining premium fuels, oil and gas, and invest them wisely in if civilization is to continue, and invest them in something. And you're asking something, and I don't have a good answer, but I'll say, okay, let's do the best we can with PVs and wind turbines, and we've got to come up with some better storage ideas if we can. And maybe we need to adjust society so there are times when there's lots of energy and times that there isn't, that you don't make aluminum around the clock, or nitrogen fertilizer around the clock. Yeah, just as an example of two very energy intensive industries. What you do is you adjust what you do to the availability of the natural energy, if we can do this. And it's not clear that we can do this. What I'm afraid most generally is this. This has been worked out very nicely by my colleague Nafees Ahmed in a really good book, Biophysical Triggers of Social Chaos. And what we have, how most people will see the, I believe, more or less inevitable future of less available energy, less energy available to society, is as inflation. And we've just seen this. I mean, we're seeing this right now on a small scale. And imagine that 10 or 100 times more. They will see it as inflation. They blame the inflation on their leaders, who, of course, can do next to nothing about it. And this has made country after country impossible to govern. Every time you look at social chaos in various countries around the world, and I could give you a long list of them, it's almost always because the government had to increase the price of gasoline or the price of buses or whatever is going on. And when this happens, whatever government is in power is almost impossible to continue governing because people are so angry. Well, this is an almost inevitable future. So what am I worried about? I am concerned about the future of Jeffersonian democracy, of which I'm an advocate, in my own country especially, and the world of inflation that will almost inevitably occur because of declining energy return on investment of our premium fuels.
Well, we were very fortunate in the 20th century, we had these giant oil fields that we discovered low cost to produce energy. But, you know, these oil fields are running out.
It isn't because of technology. The economists in something called a solo residual, we could just do a lot of discussion of economics there, attribute all of our success to technology. And, you know, that's a little bit correct, but the technology is more or less about using more and more fossil fuel. A barrel of oil does the work of one person working hard for 2 years. And you can get a, and so what does one person working hard for 2 years cost you? I don't know, $80,000 is the minimum. What does a barrel of oil cost you? $100. So that's why we're rich, because economics is about doing work, is about making things. That's a work process. Speaking as somebody trained in the natural sciences, you don't say that this occurs because of policy, or it doesn't occur because of innovation alone, or it doesn't occur because of capital, like Solow said. It happens because we use energy to transform the raw materials of nature into what we call goods and services. And we've done it very well, so we're rich. And Europe is rich, and we're used to being rich. Much of Asia is rich. Although what it also has meant is that more and more people have had more and more children, and the world has just too many bloody people, and they all want to be rich. And you can't do that unless giving every one of them more energy, and we don't have the energy to give them. And if we did, the consequences to nature, to the climate, and to different other species is very large. So there you go. We're in a tough spot, and people don't acknowledge it. One of my main things is I want to have a different kind of economics, because the economics that we have is not based on the natural sciences. It's antithetical to the natural sciences. Here's a book, Energy and the Wealth of Nations, by myself and Kent Klitgaard. And it's an approach to economics that we call biophysical economics. It's based on the reality of the natural world. Conventional economics is not. It is inconsistent with the laws of thermodynamics. It's inconsistent with the science that we know for sure. And so what the first step in all of this is that we have to change how we teach economics. And that's not going to happen tomorrow either. So until we do this, I think people are going to sit around with all kinds of false hopes that are provided by economists who say that all we have to do is do the right technology and everything will fall in place. It ain't going to happen, not easily and not that way. And, you know, I've written 300 plus scientific papers on this and 15 books. Anybody want to write me, I'll send you some of the stuff that I've been doing. chall@esf.edu is my email. And everything that I say is backed up by dozens of peer-reviewed books and papers.
You know, something that you bring up, Professor, that strikes me, you talk about the inflationary impacts of this cost of energy. Something else that has been talked about, just about every single recession that I've seen since World War II has been preceded by spikes in oil.
Look at William Hamilton's study. It's obvious. No question.
Yeah. And so it's not just inflationary, but it also has economic impacts, because as the cost goes up, it feeds right into inflation.
Well, it's because everything in our society is made of and with oil.
Yep.
So if you spend a dollar should not say $1. It should say this document pays to the bearer 5 megajoules of energy. What's 5 megajoules? It's about half a coffee cup's worth of oil. So that's what gives money its value. It's backed by oil, not it's backed by gold or something like that. It's always been true. When the Spanish brought gold back from the New World to the Old World, they doubled its quantity in the Old World and halved its value, because the real economic stuff came from the sun, from the agriculture, from the work animals, from humans working on all the things that they do, artisans and in fields and so forth and so on. All of this was the energy that was used to generate wealth, and the gold was just the means of keeping track of it. So you double the gold, you have its value. And that historically, that happened with both gold and silver in Europe. It's nothing new about this. So one problem with economics today is it's ahistorical. It doesn't look at these relations over time that are very, very clear to a natural scientist and to many historians.
You know, I want to talk about, there was a recent article by Matthew Syed in the Sunday Times, and the title was, "The Future Will Be Cold and Dark If We Don't Have a Radical Rethink. With energy, we're tinkering around the edges. New sources such as nuclear fusion are the only solution." So if you were to be appointed by the president, as energies are, and you were to look at, granted, there may not be one solution to this, how would you be reorienting and rethinking the way we're approaching this?
I'd say we have to design a society that's not based on growth. That's where I'd start. And we cannot sustain what we have, I don't think, let alone grow it. And then we should work slowly and carefully and with a much better science than we do towards developing our non-renewables. And we should do, in other words, we have to take what oil that we have left and we want to invest it wisely into making a future that'll work for our grandchildren. Is it possible? I don't know. But I think we've got to be thinking about it a lot. And yet, probably most of the people that are listening to this are in the financial world, or many of them. And the financial world is only about growth. Well, you know, guess what, folks? We're not going to be able to have this kind of growth going into the future. We don't have enough oil. We don't have enough gas. And we don't have enough copper to go into an electrical alternative. So we have to tighten our belts and let's do it wisely. If I were doing policy, now, I'm very uncomfortable you asking me this because I don't do policy, I do science. Let me talk about fusion because I was mentioned in that article this Sunday before yesterday in London Times. And the guy said very nice things about my work. But I didn't say anything about fusion in there. He went and interviewed another guy. Okay, I gave a talk about 6 years ago at the Princeton Tokamak facility, fusion facility. And I used to work at Brookhaven and Oak Ridge. I'm very familiar with the nuclear world. And they used to say back in 1970, fusion will be here in the commercial fusion in 30 years. And, you know, when 30 years went by, it's still 30 years in the future. And another 22 years has gone by and it's still 30 years in the future. And so when are we going to do fusion? Well, it keeps receding to the horizon. But the guy who was my host at nuclear at Princeton Tokamak, I said, well, look, are you going to be able to make this thing be a net energy provider? In other words, right now, there are huge energy sinks, all the materials and stuff that go into them, all the salaries and whatever. And he said, well, you know, I think we will build one successful fusion reactor, but I don't think we'll build two. And we won't build two because they're too expensive. Now, I can't tell you, I can't judge whether fusion is going to work or not. I'm not in the position, but I know a lot of people who are in that business. And I was got an email. I get all incredible emails about energy all the time. And I got an email from the former director of the U.S. Fusion Program. And he said, you know, you talk to a practical engineer about a tokamak, you know, about trying to run one of these facilities from an engineering point of view to provide reliable electricity. And he said, they'll all return to the bottle. But he was referring to it's an impossible engineering situation. You know, I used to say, even if you succeed with fusion, That doesn't solve the problem because a lot of the problems are at the other end of the wires. If you can take one battery and provide enough electricity for the world, it doesn't make the problems go away, because it's what happens is what energy allows humans to do to the rest of the world. Remember, I'm an ecologist, and I have a great deal of respect for how nature operates to generate a relatively stable system, which we are completely disrupting. Why do we do that? How are we able to do that? Because we have this massive amount of energy to change how nature works. Well, is that what we want to do? We want to, you know, live within nature, not beat it into submission.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think we got a glimpse of what we may be heading into going back to 2005 to 2008, when we saw the price of oil go from 50 to 150. We just saw a spike here where it went up to almost 120, 130. My contention is we're not going back to cheap energy.
Oh, no.
And so we better get used to this concept, as you brought up. Our economic system, the way it's driven right now, I come from the financial field. So everything's about growth, earnings growth, GDP growth. And how are you going to have that if you don't have cheap energy? I just don't see it.
I don't either.
So as we close, Professor, you've written a number of books. If there was one book you would want our listeners to read to understand the concepts we've been talking here, which one of your books would that be?
Well, there's two. A little one is called Energy Return on Investment, A Unifying Principle for Biology, Economics, and Sustainability. I'd like every freshman to read that. It's not going to happen, but I'd like that. And the second one, Energy and the Wealth of Nations, An Introduction to Biophysical Economics. Both of these are available from Springer. They're available for not very much money electronically, and for more money as a hardcover. And so, repeating again, Energy Return on Investment is one, and Energy and the Wealth of Nations is another. The guy who wrote the editorial for the London Times, Syed, said he called me up, he said, I just read this from cover to cover. It's fantastic. And it should be, I hope I'm not putting words in his mouth, it should be used as the basic economics textbook for everybody taking introductory economics. And I certainly agree, because it covers the conventional economic concepts, you know, these crossing lines and stuff, supply and demand. And it also criticizes it and replaces it with a natural science-based approach, which we call biophysical economics, with lots and lots of examples, lots of data, lots of graphs. And so there's 2.5 million copies that have been sold by Springer. So somebody's reading it. We live in a bubble. What economics deals with, the quote in the Sunday Times is even better. I'm quoting myself, but I thought I said it very well in this one. Howell puts it starkly, economics lives in a contrived world of its own, one only tangentially connected to what occurs in real economic systems. And I'm not the only one to say this, by the way. Nobel Prize winner in economics, Vasily Leontief, said that 30 years ago in Science magazine. He said economics is disconnected from reality. It's just based on a series of artificial assumptions, you know, Pareto optimality, all kinds of stuff. And even Adam Smith wrote two books. You ought to read the other one. And it's a lot less supportive of the concept of free markets. Adam Smith liked the idea of free markets for some things, but not for others. And incidentally, I wrote this book with an economic historian. So the Energy and the Wealth of Nations. And so the economics in that is really good, because it isn't written by a contemporary economist who has only one view of economics, but it's written from the perspective of how people looked at economics over hundreds of years. And it's very different from the neoclassical economics that dominates what we do now. And incidentally, for people who are interested in this, please go to www.bpeinstitute.org, Biophysical Economics Institute. And there it is. There's about half a dozen people high up in industry, in oil companies even and so forth, who found me and said, we don't like how we are being forced to do ESG, environmental, social, and governmental stuff. We think that's leading us to a lot of very poor decisions. Do you have a better idea? And I think we do have better ideas. And so they thought that, just for starters, energy return on investment was a much better way to think about investments than ESG. So we're throwing a lot of, let me just give you an example. There's all kinds of, because nobody knows what ESG really means. Normally people try to reduce carbon, and one way to reduce carbon is to take it out of the air. And so my colleague, June Sequeira, examined 200 different studies, all she could find, of taking carbon out of the air, not with trees, but with machinery. And she found in every single one of them, there was not one of them that was a net remover of carbon. So we're throwing all this money down a rat hole to supposedly take CO2 out of the air with machines that often use more energy to run the machines and hence dump more CO2 in the air than you remove. And so there's all kinds of, another good one is corn ethanol. It takes a joule, energy unit, a calorie of fossil fuel to make a calorie of alcohol from corn. And so you have no net energy gain. All you have for a net is the soil erosion, because corn is a very erosive crop and it's very destructive to wildlife by destroying all the habitat to grow something that's just going in a circle, using as much energy as we get out of it. And we need a much better, ideally federal or who knows, but evaluative procedure, because we're making all kinds of stupid decisions in the name of painting things green. Greenwashing, we call it.
Well, listen, we'll put your books on the site.
Okay.
And good. I'll have you back on again.
Well, you can write me whatever you think, chall@esf.edu, including any critical comments. I'm happy to have them.
Well, Professor, hopefully those in power in Washington will read your book, because in the direction that we're going, as that article in the Sunday Times talked about, a very dark reality lies ahead of us unless we start doing a rethink. Professor, I want to thank you for joining us here on the program. Very enlightening, and I want to wish you all the best, and we'll keep our fingers crossed, and hopefully we have a change in course.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense NewsHour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888-486-3939, or go to financialsense.com and click where it says Contact Us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.